This is an iHeart original.
Imagine it's 1876 and you're riding the passenger trains from Chicago to San Francisco. The steam engine has rumbled through the Great Plains, wheeled up the Rockies, and descended onto the vast salt flats of Utah. Now, you're surrounded by the desert of Nevada. The train bends around a canyon and slows. Ahead, you see a little town with a depot, a corral with some horses, and a saloon. As the train lurches to a stop, the conductor tells you that the engine is filling up on water. Passengers have 10 minutes to stretch their legs. You step outside onto the station platform, and it feels like you've walked into an oven. The town is dead. The horses at the corral swat flies with their tails. A lone cowboy leans against the fence. Suddenly, the cowboy spits in the dirt and points his finger at a man walking down the street.
There you are, you low-down polecat.
The cowboy's hand hovers over the ivory handle of a pistol.
I've been waiting for you. I'm gonna kill you because of what you did to my sister.
The cowboy pulls off an elaborate quick draw. And that is your introduction to Palisade, Nevada. In the 1870s, Palisade was the meanest little town west of the Mississippi. Every week, newspapers announced a cowboy gunfight or an Indian massacre, or some gunpowder-fueled drama with bank robbers duking it out against highway bandits. Palisade put the wild in the Wild West. But there was a lot more to the story that didn't make the papers. Welcome to Very Special Episodes, an iHeart original podcast. I'm your host, Dana Schwartz, and this is Westward Hoax.
Welcome to Very Special Episodes indeed. My name is Jason English, and I'm joined by two California-based podcast legends, Dana Schwartz and Zarin Burnett. Hey, guys.
What up, Jason?
Oh, thank you for that intro.
I mentioned your state of residence for a reason. Let me pull back the curtain here. I'm in New Jersey. We're recording this on a Friday, and I just lived through my first earthquake.
Ooh, how are you feeling?
You know, it's a lot of excitement. I would imagine in California, a 4.8 probably doesn't trigger multiple emergency calls and texts and emails and push alerts. And
only from
schools.
Family out of state.
I've never felt an earthquake. I've lived in California for a pretty long time, and I always either just like sleep through them. I'm a really heavy sleeper, so it's never been a thing that I've dealt with. And I kind of feel left out. Like, everyone on Twitter and, like, you know, social media is always like, oh, my God, did you feel that? And I'm just like, no.
Zarin, have you lived through your share?
Oh, my God. Same experience as Dana. I've lived in California for a long time. I lived in L.A. through a number of earthquakes. But I always happened to leave town right before the earthquake, so I'd always miss it. And then people would tell me, Burnett, you missed it again. I was like, oh, man. So when I finally got to live through an earthquake, I was so excited. Everyone else is like, man, this sucks. And I'm like, no, this is the best. You feel that rumbling? Oh, my God. The waves? Yeah.
That feels evolutionary. Like, in your bones, you know when to get away from danger in advance.
But I have the exact opposite with cars on fire. So, you know, give and take.
So, well, the curtain is pulled back. This room is not soundproofed for aftershocks. I'm just letting you know if this is going to become a thing, you're going to hear it in the recording. But today's story is going to keep you a little bit off balance, too.
I think the only thing that I love more than sort of a hoax is one that basically involves an entire town getting together to be an improv troupe.
Yes, totally.
It's very wholesome.
That's the dream.
It really is the dream.
Always say yes. I like how the Palisades, Nevada is like, well, just all of Nevada. It's like the Australia of America. It's just amazing. And I don't know if you guys know this, but in Australia, they have the spirit of messing with authority figures that they call larrikinism. And this feels like larrikinism in America.
Larrikinism. That's a great vocab word.
This is the best.
I want to take you back to the start of that gunfight, because there was a part we missed.
My poor, poor little sister.
The dandy falls to the dirt. His body goes limp. Blood starts to soak through his shirt. Mayhem ensues. Men pour out of the saloon. Little kids pull back curtains and peer out of windows to see what the commotion is about. Meanwhile, you and the gaggle of out-of-towners push back into the train car. As the engine lurches forward, you look out the window and see two men dragging a lifeless body down the dusty street. A group of wranglers have accosted the cowboy, apparently to take him to the sheriff. Meanwhile, a fistfight has broken out in front of the saloon. You hear distant gunshots and whoops and shouts as the train pulls away. Palisade disappears behind you. Once you're out of sight, the cowboy and his victim clink glasses in the saloon. The rest of the townsfolk would be huddled around them, slapping each other's backs with a laugh.
Did you see the look on their faces? Boy, we got them good.
Palisade was reportedly home to hundreds, maybe thousands, of gunfights like this. And all of them were fake. The gunfights, the Indian massacres, even the blood were all part of an elaborate, staged hoax. Palisade wasn't the most dangerous town in the West. It was the prankiest. In the 1870s, Palisade, Nevada was just a humble waypoint along the Central Pacific Railroad.
It's a mining town, and so life would be very hard.
That's Nicholas Witchie. He's a dean and professor of English at Western Michigan University. He specializes in the Wild West and has written about Palisade.
Most people would be working 10-hour days, 6 days a week, blowing up rock, smacking rock with a pickaxe, hauling it in wagons or wheelbarrows. They're getting paid lousy day wages to move rock around all day long.
Life in this small, isolated desert town didn't resemble the Wild West of popular imagination. In fact, here's how a reporter of the weekly Elko Independent described it back in 1876.
The town is unusually dull, but still those who are in business don't growl. They simply pray for better times.
In other words, life in Palisade was kinda, well, boring. People were barely scraping by. There wasn't a theater for entertainment, and the saloon could only distract you for so long. There was also a lot of tension in the air, too. Mining and railroad towns like Palisade were home to a lot of foreign laborers, particularly Chinese workers. Not everybody took too kindly to the visitors.
Tensions over the Chinese coming in and taking jobs was really ramping up.
Chinese workers were frequently victims of xenophobia and exclusionary laws. The hard lifestyle, the boredom, the racial tensions, all of this made life in this hardscrabble town even more tough. And people were desperate to blow off some steam. So rather than fight each other, the town found a common target. The gullible tourists passing through on the Transcontinental Railroad.
What are you going to do when train pulls into town and you've been schlepping rock for 10 hours a day? Why not have a little fun?
In 1876, most people traveling west had no concept of Nevada. Maybe they had read about cowboys and Indians in the yellow pages of tawdry dime novels. So the people of Palisade decided to give them a show.
These travelers would step out onto the platform, and next thing you know, there'd be buckets of blood all over the platform, and then screaming and dead bodies being hauled off, and then the tourists would all pile into the train and be shaking and frightened and worried about this wordless Wild West that they'd come into, and the train would pull out of town. All the dead bodies would rise, and everybody would go to the saloon and have a good laugh because they just put one over on the tourists.
residents of Palisade leaned into the stereotype of the Wild West. You know, cowboys in big hats yelling yee-haw as they fight Native Americans. Bounty hunters on horseback lassoing murderous outlaws, dragging them to the gallows for justice. Thing is, these stereotypes aren't accurate now, and they weren't accurate then.
What we think of the American West is a bunch of guys blasting away at each other. Yes, there was a gunfight at the OK Corral, but that lasted 30 seconds. In the meantime, there were scores of people living, working, going to shows, going to restaurants, doing what they do, coming, going, the mines, all sorts of things.
The fact is, life in the Wild West wasn't that wild. It wasn't even that dangerous.
The element of the American West that we often associate with lawlessness and violence, it was real. It was a part of what was going on in the West. But most scholars are pretty quick to point out that in terms of numbers, the prevalence of gun use, the prevalence of violence, the prevalence of hangings was really not much greater than it was in other parts of the country at that time.
Even the stereotypical image of cowboys, a white John Wayne figure ready to get into a shootout at any moment, isn't entirely correct.
Yes, there were cowboys. Yes, they wore big hats and chaps, and some of them even carried guns. But at the same time, fully half of them were either Hispanic or African-American.
In fact, most of these stereotypes of a rootin' tootin' Wild West started with novelists like Ned Buntline. In 1869, Buntline interviewed William F. Cody, a buffalo hunter and army scout who had served during the American Indian Wars. The result was a sensationalist story called Buffalo Bill, the King of the Border Men. It would eventually become part of a new genre of cheaply made books called dime novels that swept the country. They introduced readers to a world where cowboys and Indians, gunslingers and outlaws reigned.
The dime novels certainly had their function as telling the story about the American West in ways that are, you know, blood and thunder is the phrase that's often used to describe the dime novel experience.
You know the old journalism chestnut, if it bleeds, it leads? That was the dime novel in a nutshell. In addition to getting readers hooked on a fictional Wild West, Ned Buntline helped convince Buffalo Bill to give up his job hunting buffalo for the glitzy lights of show business.
Ned Buntline is the guy who also gets William F. Cody, Buffalo Bill, to portray himself on stage. And so 1872, Buffalo Bill starts performing in New York what it's like to be Buffalo Bill in the wild.
Buffalo Bill would soon become a full-time showman with his own traveling circus. Audience members could watch reenactments of Indian attacks and see live acts like the sharpshooter Annie Oakley, who, by the way, was born and raised not in the Wild West, but in Ohio. All of this is to say, dime novels and Old West acts, as well as newspaper coverage of the Indian Wars, such as Custer's Last Stand, built a stereotype that the West was a violent, lawless place, perpetually clouded with gun smoke. So the citizens of Palisade decided to help.
I see a group of people who are like, okay, this is what the world expects of us. Let's give it to them.
In October of 1876, a journalist with the Virginia City Territorial Enterprise witnessed the Palisade prank in action.
A half a dozen Native Americans, for a reasonable compensation, would submit to being bound hand and foot and laid on the platform during the stay of the train. Around their bodies, a guard of citizens armed with immense revolvers, long rifles, and bloodthirsty-looking knives would march. Shotguns and revolvers were loaded with powder, ball omitted, and in a moment the air would reek with powder smoke and profanity. And blood, previously procured from the slaughterhouse, besprinkled the platform as plentifully as water. Sympathetic friends carried off the dead and wounded to some neighboring saloon, while the frightened and bewildered immigrants crawled from under seats and behind cars. Their blanched faces and trembling limbs attesting their belief in the genuineness of the fight.
Hoaxes like this weren't exactly new. In 1866, the Union Pacific Railroad entertained its workers by staging a phony fight between the Pawnee and Sioux. But in Palisade, this wasn't a one-off. According to the historian Gerald B. Higgs, who wrote the book Lost Legends of the Silver State, the ruse lasted for 3 years. Over that time, the Palisade Thespian Players, as they allegedly called themselves, put on more than 1,000 acts. Basically, the residents of Palisade had become an improv troupe that put on a show every night. According to Higgs, local authorities and the railroad workers were all in on the joke, and the hoax was making Palisade sort of famous. Palisade was getting write-ups in editorials across the country, with travelers complaining about their terrifying experiences passing through the Nevada town. Frankly, it's a brilliant tale. Decades before Wild West amusement parks like Frontier Town were ever invented, the residents of a real frontier town were playing the part and punking gullible, highfalutin outsiders on the daily. There's just one problem. There's no evidence the Palisade pranks ever happened.
One of the questions that I could never resolve was, were they actually real?
The story of the Palisade hoax might be a hoax. If you were alive during the 1870s, you were living through what was, if you'll pardon my French, a golden age of bullshit. There were quacks, hucksters, and charlatans galore. Schmucks and spiritualists occupied every street corner, hawking snake oil, salvation, and direct lines to the dead. P.T. Barnum had turned the art of the prank into a money-making bonanza. Meanwhile, at every carnival funhouse, you could see the bodies of petrified giants and the flaky husks of desiccated mermaids.
It's an interesting time for a lot of people fooling around or being fooled.
That, again, is Professor Nick Witchy of Western Michigan University. And he explained that people in Palisade, Nevada, were living smack in the middle of Bullshit Central.
Why were the residents of Palisades so seemingly interested in punking travelers coming through? The shortest, quickest answer is they were living in a part of the country that was already well deeply invested in hoaxes, in satires, in poking fun at people's misconceptions.
Nevada was a hoaxster's paradise, he tells us. One of the big reasons is because it was home to a little newspaper called the Virginia City Territorial Enterprise. Located in a silver boom town in West Nevada, the Virginia City Territorial Enterprise was a paper where good and honest journalism shared the page with shenanigan-filled fake news. If you picked up the newspaper on October 28, 1863, you could read an account of a bloody massacre that happened in nearby Carson, Nevada. Apparently, a man had gone mad and butchered his wife and six of his children. Then he hopped on a horse and took the knife to himself.
About 10 o'clock on Monday evening, Hopkins dashed into Carson on horseback with his throat cut from ear to ear and bearing in his hand a reeking scalp from which the warm, smoking blood was still dripping.
But the story was fake, totally made up. And just guess what happened to the journalist who concocted this fiction? Did he get fired? Was he tarred and feathered, banished from the writing business forever? Of course not. He became famous. The reporter's name was Samuel Clemens, who you probably know better as Mark Twain.
This is a part of the country where Mark Twain got his name. And he really started in journalism with satires and hoaxes. publishing news stories about things that never happened or silly or horrific things that would frighten people if they didn't know better.
At the Virginia City Paper, Twain was making up stories all the time. And he wasn't alone.
He had a whole fellow crew of journalists at the Virginia City Territorial Enterprise who were writing up hoaxes.
Like Twain, journalists Dan DeQuille and Fred Hart were routinely publishing phony satires. There was the story about a dead man who had turned into solid rock.
A petrified man was found some time ago in the mountains south of Gravelly Ford.
And a story about a man who turned into a human popsicle under the glaring desert sun.
He was dead and frozen stiff. An icicle over a foot in length hung from his nose.
Years after leaving the newspaper, Mark Twain recalled the joy of making up stories in the Territorial Enterprise office.
We never hesitated about devising hoaxes when the public needed matters of thrilling interest for breakfast. The seemingly tranquil Enterprise office was a ghastly factory of slaughter, mutilation, and general destruction in those days.
Nowadays, these journalists are remembered as the Sagebrush School of Writers. They were a product of their time. The media landscape was changing fast. Telegraphs, literacy rates, and newspaper distribution were booming. And these writers decided to exploit it.
The right mix of people suddenly landed all in the same place and felt like, you know what? We can have some fun with this.
So they used humor and tall tales to write satires, poking fun at the people in power. And readers were okay with this, because BS was a currency in the West.
It was a world where value shifted rapidly. One day, the price of silver could be through the roof, and the next day, the price of silver would be so low that it wouldn't be worthwhile to pull it out of the ground. In a world of shifting values, what can you hang your hat on? Some people think that the hoaxes all came about because of that very reason, that this was a world where the one thing you could know for certain was the ability to BS, was the ability to bullshit someone into thinking you had the key to a really interesting piece of knowledge.
But also, let's be real, the writers also enjoyed a certain pastime.
They drank a lot. They were a thirsty group.
Now, a lot of the stories by the Sagebrush writers got picked up by other newspapers and published as truth. Some stories were published in places as far away as Australia. Local readers, however, weren't so gullible. They usually knew the stories were fake.
The local journalist would put in enough clues to let the reader in on the joke, but the reader farther away would not necessarily know.
And that brings us back to the Palisade prank. Because here's the weird thing about it. According to lore, the people of Palisade pranked unsuspecting train passengers more than 1,000 times. You'd imagine this would get a lot of write-ups in various newspapers. But when we scoured databases in search of evidence of the prank, we only found one article. And it was from the Virginia City Territorial Enterprise. Yeah, the newspaper riddled with hoaxes and fake news. Dr. Witchy bumped into the same problem back when he was researching the Palisade story.
When I first was researching this and writing this paper, historians in the editing process kept asking me, but is it real? Did it happen? Could things like this have happened? Were there other examples of this sort of thing happening?
He didn't have an answer.
I personally have never found anything to corroborate that they actually happened.
Most accounts about the prank, including ours, come from Gerald B. Higgs, an amateur historian who wrote about the hoax back in 1976. Higgs says he learned about it by talking to old-timers and visiting every county recorder's office in Nevada. However, he doesn't cite any sources in his telling of the Palisade pranks. Is it possible that the Palisade prank was just another prank pulled off by the writers of the Virginia City Territorial Enterprise? It's hard to tell. Dr. Witchy told us that newspaper hoaxes usually contained telltale clues that would tip off local readers that the story was phony. But he couldn't find any hints in the Palisade story.
This is one of the things that's distinctive about that report about the Palisade hoax. If it really is a hoax, this journalist is describing it in such a way that makes it plain. Like, guess what the folks over in Palisade are doing to tourists?
The story is written like a plain news item. If the article itself is a hoax, it's a subtle one. But perhaps we shouldn't be surprised. The Virginia City Territorial Enterprise is, after all, famous for duping people. Even into the 20th century, the newspaper was publishing pranks. In the 1950s, the editors published a fake story about a camel race coming to town. There was no camel race, of course. It was all a joke. But another newspaper decided to call them on it. And now, Virginia City hosts an annual camel and ostrich race. Which, if you haven't seen adults ride ostriches down a desert drag strip, is worth the trip. Meanwhile, Palisade today is a ghost town. The mines in the area went bust. The local post office skedaddled in the 60s. In 2005, the news website SFGate described what's left of Palisade as, quote, tumbleweeds, rattlesnake holes, half of a rusted car, the remains of an old washing machine, and a cemetery. All that's really left is a story that Nevadans love to share.
It is utterly fascinating to me that a story that may or may not be true, regardless, has become a story that the people of Nevada love to tell about themselves and love to tell each other, that this is the kind of place that we've inherited. This is the place we live in.
The stories we choose to tell and the stories we choose to believe say a lot about who we are and how we identify. So perhaps it's appropriate to close with a coda. One last story about how Palisade, for the briefest of moments, was the most talked about town in the country. It was Election Day, 1932. President Herbert Hoover was riding a train back to his home state of California to vote. But as the train came upon Palisade, it lurched to a stop. The Associated Press reported that the night before, two men had been caught carrying 17 sticks of dynamite, apparently in an attempt to blow up the bridge and, quote, wreck the Hoover train. They even tried to shoot and stab the guard keeping watch over the tracks. This was huge news, an election assassination attempt in Palisade. The town of 300 was making front page headlines in papers across the country. 2 weeks later, a follow-up appeared in the papers. The guard who had witnessed the dastardly assassination plot had a confession. He had made it all up. Palisade's 15 minutes of fame was a hoax, too.
So do you think it was real?
Yes, I think it was real the first time. And then after that,
I think it at least happened once. And they were like, this is so funny. It's like a great bit.
Yeah.
You don't want a great bit to die.
You only need to do it once because no one wants to be the only people who got fooled. So everyone will play it up for you.
Exactly. That's the whole nature of the Old West. Something happens once and everybody gets their hand at the storytelling and it just gets bigger and better through the over and over storytelling.
My very special character for this one, kind of a very special cameo, my man Mark Twain, who pops up out of nowhere. Gets some quality minutes off the bench there.
Missouri's finest.
You know, the classic thing where TV show will spin off a minor character into its own show. Frasier, the most obvious example from Cheers.
Yeah.
Saul Goodman from Breaking Bad.
Yep.
Mrs. Garrett, Facts of Life to Different Strokes.
Hell yeah.
Wow. Yeah. A lot of, people who are familiar with The Good Wife, that whole universe.
Mm-hmm. Elspeth. Is that the new one?
Is a spinoff, yeah.
One of the first spinoffs was Gomer Pyle from Andy Griffith, and then that became a more popular show. It was the bigger hit.
Well, in that spirit, Zarin is working on another episode, Mark Twain-centric. It's kind of like Mark Twain's origin story. And so we're just teasing that here, that going to spin him off into his own bigger thing. So to be on the lookout.
He gets a whole episode where you learn that he basically is part of a bar fight that starts American literature. It's a wild story. And then also you get more of the Virginia City Territorial Enterprise, which is an amazing newspaper.
Did you happen to cast this one?
I did, actually. Thank you for asking. This one, I went with a comical variety of casting. So imagine this as a comedy, right? So we have Buffalo Bill as the showman, played by John C. Reilly, right? Ned Buntline, the novelist, played by Owen Wilson. Then how about this?
Oh, I love that.
You like that one, Dana? Okay. Nicholas Witchy, the historian, Sam Elliott as our narrator.
I kind of feel like this is a Wes Anderson ensemble.
Totally.
That we're building. It feels like a Wes Anderson movie.
You nailed it, right? And then so now for the Palisade Thespian players, your favorites, the improv artists themselves, I just imagined a group, right? So we have the mayor of Palisade. That would be played by Walton Goggins. We have the cool gunfighter, Lakeith Stanfield. Saloon owner, Danny McBride. How about for our Lady of Entertainment in the Night, Billie Eilish in her first dramatic role. And then finally, gullible tourist couple, Tom Holland and Zendaya.
You know what? For mine, I'm going to really go with the Wes Anderson theme.
Yes.
And the people in the town are like Jason Schwartzman.
Okay.
Edward Norton. Adrian Brody is the journalist.
Oh, yes.
And then like one of the hapless tourists is like, is a couple. And it's like Bob Balaban and like Tilda Swinton.
I
want
love
them on
this.
The train. Yeah.
That anytime Bob Balaban, I mean, you got me. Like, I'm already pulling money out of my wallet.
Can't you picture him as just like a hapless tourist watching this and then Tilda Swinton just like being aghast
totally.
As another trained person?
The faces she could pull? Come on now.
Oh, yeah. Probably wearing weird teeth the whole time.
You guys nailed the dramatic recreations. I think there's also a competition reality show angle where improv troops are brought into small towns and have to pull off some major scam like this.
See, but Jason, here's my main takeaway. It's not a scam if it's not for profit. If you're not, a benevolent scam is a hoax.
Exactly.
This is a hoax. And I actually think that we need more hoaxes in this country.
Totally.
Just good spirited, entertaining hoaxes. We're not trying to hurt anyone. Mm-hmm. We're not trying to steal anyone's money. This is just a hoax.
Yeah, just put the vibe in the air and let people have a good laugh. I love that.
Let people have a good time. Let's self-mythologize what America is.
Yes.
And I think that that's what this episode is. This episode is about America self-mythologizing in real time.
Totally. And also the tendencies that we have. Because, okay, the Old West, right? They had the dime novels like pumping the story and the newspapers carrying it back east. But it basically, the Old West was the Oakland or the Chicago of back then, where it's just a hype of crime. It wasn't really as bad as people made it out, but they're like, oh, man, I hate to go out to the Old West or, you know, I guess the Wild West at that point. Just like people don't want to go to Chicago or where I live, Oakland, where it's come on out here, man. We're ready for you. It'll be fun.
No baseball, but.
Yeah, dude, don't talk about that. Come on now. Sacramento taking our team like that.
Very Special Episodes is made by some very special people. This show is hosted by Dana Schwartz, Zarin Burnett, and me, Jason English. Today's episode was written by Lucas Riley. Our producer is Josh Fisher. Editing and sound design by Chris Childs. Mixing and mastering by Bahid Frazier. Original music by Elise McCoy. Research and fact-checking by Austin Thompson and Lucas Riley. Show logo by Lucy Quintanilla. Special thanks to our voice actors, Zarin, Josh, and Carl Cadle. I'm your executive producer. We'll see you back here next Wednesday. Very Special Episodes is a production of iHeart Podcasts.